This is the Mindful Musical Life Podcast. I'm Kevin Miske. Today, my guest is Dr. Anne-Marie Cherry. Dr. Cherry is a versatile performer and educator, enjoying a varied career as a soloist, chamber musician, orchestral musician, clinician, and recording artist. She performs with orchestras nationwide, including recent engagements with the Kaleidoscope Chamber Orchestra, Spokane Symphony, Pro Musica Chamber Orchestra, and the Austin Symphony, and she spends her summers as co-principal horn of the Breckenridge Festival in Breckenridge, Colorado. Dr. Cherry currently serves as assistant professor of horn at the Columbus State University Schwab School of Music, and has previously been on the faculties of the University of Texas at Austin, Spokane Falls Community College, and the Pasadena City College. In this conversation, Anne-Marie talks about her five facets of mindfulness, how she incorporates mindfulness into teaching and her own warm-up routine, the importance of really going for it when performing, and we talk about her suggestions for being in tune with our own mind states while participating as an audience member. Anne-Marie has a very clear and approachable way of talking about mindfulness and is just a delightful person. So without further ado, here is Dr. Anne-Marie Cherry. Hi, Anne-Marie. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. It's great to hear from you again.
Yeah. Let's start by discussing kind of how you got interested in mindfulness and talk a little bit about kind of what your own personal practice looks like now as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I got into mindfulness through kind of a different angle than a lot of people. I was taking a class on music in the brain in my doctorate. And as part of that class, we were looking at performance anxiety specifically. And so I was doing a bunch of research on various treatments for that. And of course, mindfulness was up in the mix in that kind of thing. And so that's how I first started looking into it. And that kind of transformed into a research interest throughout my doctorate. So for the first couple of years that mindfulness was on my radar, it was definitely in kind of like an academic setting, if that makes any sense, or very cerebral. And it wasn't until after my doctorate was over that I really started to apply it to myself and to my own musical life, which I know is kind of ironic. But I was prepping for a huge audition and I was just really overwhelmed. And I felt like I just couldn't focus. I'd pick the horn up and I'd look at this list and I'd think about the job and it just was like so much that I couldn't even get started. And I knew something had to change. And so I just kind of haphazardly was like, okay, I'm going to start with this thing. And it says, you know, breathing exercise, metronome at 60. And I just did my entire fundamentals routine at 60. And I did that for a couple of days and started to realize that what I was doing was turning my fundamentals into a form of a mindfulness meditation via the horn. And all of a sudden the light bulb started to go off about the things I had been researching and what that was revealing about my own approach to the horn when I would pick it up, especially when it came to something like an audition, which was really stressful. And can feel very high stakes. So that's kind of how I got into mindfulness, both from a research perspective and in my own playing. And that continues to be true. I mean, now I'm fortunate enough to get to speak to students at various academic institutions about mindfulness in your own practice, pedagogy, and performance, and to work with my own students on that also. But even though that routine is not the same, that fundamentals routine has shifted over the years, there is that aspect of it of having a heartbeat through it where I'm kind of giving my brain and my body a chance to kind of calibrate and meet in the middle before I play any notes on the horn. So those notes can be really intentional and have a lot of mindfulness, that kind of habit of mind in them as I approach them. So yeah, that's how mindfulness came into my life.
Great. I would imagine that a lot of musicians, and I think a lot of people in general, tend to start with mindfulness as this, like, I'm just going to like think my way into being mindfulness. You know,
yeah.
Like you kind of read a bunch of stuff about it, or you listen to a bunch of, you know, podcasts or blogs or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, that makes sense. Okay. I'll just kind of do that. But I think that part about the intentional aspects of mindfulness is really important.
Yeah. Yeah. There's this this model for mindful thinking in some of the research that I read that's just abbreviated IAA, intention and awareness. And then, I'm forgetting my third A because I'm the worst because I'm stressed. intention, action, and awareness. And so basically you set an intention, right? So on your instrument, this can be something like, I am going to work on long tones for intonation, right? It doesn't have to be a complicated intention. So then what you're assessing is not, okay, so is it my most beautiful sound? Do I feel, you know, the things you kind of simplify it down to in this feedback loop, am I setting my goals? Am I working towards those goals? Do I have awareness up to when I've achieved them? And if not, how can I refine that work? And so it's this nice little working model that kind of loops back and forth that I think sometimes when we're practicing and we feel lost can be helpful, or in that moment when we're trying to decide if we've actually achieved something in our practice can be really great. But just this idea of intention and bringing intention to what we do on the horn, both what we say, or any instrument really, like what we want to say, and how we want to say it, and how we want to feel when we're saying it. And I think those are all really important areas that you can examine intention in what you do. Yeah.
That's great. Would you mind elaborating just a little bit on maybe an example of an intention? Like, let's say that you're using this model within like your warm-up session or your routine, however you refer to that. Yeah. Maybe give us an example or two about how to kind of structure that from a very specific standpoint, if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I feel like I observe in a lot of my students these days is partly because we've all been playing over Zoom for so long, and it's weird that one of the easiest things to lose your compass on by yourself is how you're using your air, right? Which is so ironic because we're breathing beautifully all the time. Our bodies love to use air efficiently, but somehow when we pick up our instruments, we don't always do that. And so it can start with a breathing exercise, where it's just in for this many counts and out for this many counts. Doug Hill has a really great one where it's just, you set your metronome at 60, and the counts start doubling. So in for three, out for six, in for four, out for eight, et cetera, until it goes through. And all you're focusing on is, are you moving the air, with your body in a very relaxed position? Right. And so there's no buzzing in that. There's no right or wrong pitches. It's just, am I relaxed and moving air efficiently? And then when you start to add to that, it's like, okay, now I'm in a place where my air is really moving in a comfortable way, where I'm spending it evenly over these counts, where I don't feel like I'm holding it and carrying tension in my chest or my throat. Then when you pick up a mouthpiece to buzz, if you're taking that air, and this is now the foundation for what you're going to do, and you just say, have that same intention with a new element, now there's pitch. And then you add length of tubing when you add the horn. It all just kind of becomes an intention of using your air in a really efficient and relaxed way to initiate the sound, which I think is so much better than making a sound and then being like, oh yeah, now I have to go back and figure out how to get my air moving. Like, if you can start from that place, I find it's much more relaxing, at least for me, when I'm playing. And I think that for so many of us, when it comes to our nerves, at least for me, that's where I notice it most often physically, is my breath feels really tight. And so if I can come back to breath and I can invite that as a habit of my horn playing, and how I begin my day is by like kind of inviting this relaxed airflow and just spending air evenly, it seems to really translate into an intention that can be really powerful.
So I think what I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, but is the idea of your intention would be, for example, with the breath exercise. I love that Doug Hill exercise, by the way. Super so simple, fun. But so yeah. Effective.
Yeah.
And then transferring that intention of relaxation and calmness with the breath, and then changing the process, which would be breathing for that. And then the process would be long tones on the mouthpiece, and then process long tones on the instrument or flexibility on the instrument.
Yeah.
But the intention is basically staying the same throughout all those exercises. Is that kind of?
Yeah, exactly. And then you're just adding maybe a new way of illustrating that, right? So in the beginning, it's purely just moving air with your body, and then it's adding the vibration of the lips. And then it's adding, you know, the tone of the horn, and then it's changing pitches on the horn. But it's all coming from that same lens, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, you can take any of those exercises and have a different intention with them, which is also really valuable. You know, so for me, I guess the real intention there is relaxation and ease in the moving of air as you add these many different lenses. You're exactly right. That would be the intention.
Great. So what's something, since we're kind of in the realm of students and working and like from a, you know, an instructor or a teacher standpoint viewpoint, mm-hmm. What are some of the things you notice tend to happen? Let's say that you're coaching a student through like a breathing exercise or buzzing, and they're being able to keep that intention of staying relaxed. What are some of the things you notice about tension or sound or things that change when we go to switch to something, you know, like a solo piece or an etude or something that's a little bit more complicated? Where are some of the places that you notice like a somewhat detrimental change?
Sure. Well, I think all of us bring in habits, both physical habits and habits of mind, especially if it's something we've played before or that we have a preconceived notion about, right? So the first time you pick up a solo that someone has told you is hard, you instinctively brace yourself for the fact that it's hard, and that comes with a lot of tension, or sometimes even being really timid in how you approach it. And so it is often very true, even, you know, pros, we do this. We can be as relaxed and efficient as we want in our warm-up, and then we sit down and it's somehow it feels different when it's like, oh, now I have to play the opening of Einheldenleben, or, you know, something right. like that, right? That's like dicey. And so I think it's really interesting in that moment, if you can kind of keep it seamless, where it's like when I would use the metronome in my warm-up that I mentioned, that was a way of doing it where it was just everything had to just kind of line up with this pulse that was outside of my body, but kind of, you know, felt very organic. And I was just lining things up. And then when I would try and start things in that same kind of a way, like I've reinforced this kind of body rhythm of doing this so many times by the time I get to the hard thing that I can start it from a different place, right? And it's really interesting to me when we talk about mindfulness, it can sometimes become this like big floaty idea. And that is absolutely true. But there are also lots of interesting ways that like researchers have tried to dissect what is it really and how does it show up in people's lives, especially in, you know, the treatment of chronic illnesses or stress or things like that. So there's a researcher, Ruth Baer, I hope I'm saying her last name correctly, B-A-E-R, and she identified these five facets of mindfulness that I think are really interesting. So it's observing, describing, acting with awareness, non-judgment, and non-reactivity. And so if you think about that in a musical setting, most of our training, right, is helping us to be very judgmental and somewhat reactive to what we do, right? We are good observers of things often, right? Like that was out of tune. We kind of think about it as error detection, or I missed that note, or that's higher, that's low, or, you know, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But when you get to the last three, I feel like that's where sometimes our musical training kind of causes a speed bump in the road. Like we've all practiced scales mindlessly just because we had to, or had a thing where a teacher told us you need to practice this and we're not really sure why, we just do it because our teacher told us to, or because we feel like we should, right? Like I should be able to play this thing. And so I think it's kind of interesting because all of us are hardwired a little bit differently. Our brains work differently. Our awareness of self is very different. So when you can get students to figure out which one of these five facets is the one that's kind of, you know, lagging behind the others right now, ideally we want them to be really balanced, right? So that non-judgment and non-reactivity, the difference between I cracked a note, so I'm a failure, versus I cracked that note, so maybe I should approach it differently, if that makes any sense. Or, you know, that it loops back into that feedback of intention when it's like, okay, I'm not going to react to that. Like it doesn't have emotional portent just because it didn't go the way I intended. It's just a thing that happened. There's an analogy, I think it's in Kabat-Zinn's book, Wherever You Go, There You Are, where he talks about observing emotions as they pass by you. It's like, you know, sitting on the bank of a river and watching the river flow by and realizing that the river is always there, but it's different water that you're watching all the time. And that the same thing can be true. We don't have to react to each individual drop of water. We can just watch the river go by. And it's the same thing with our emotions sometimes. So I think that to kind of loop back to what you're asking, sorry about that long answer.
No, that was great. Keep going.
Is that with students, the moment that, you know, things can be going really, really well, and I include myself in this because we're all our own students at some point. And then the moment there's a speed bump, it's that last piece, that non-reactivity or that non-judgment that can pop up. That's where I find that cultivating mindfulness is the most beneficial because it allows us to see this kind of inner turbulence as a thing that's going to pass by. It's not who we are. It's what we're experiencing in that moment or our frustration that day. But that, you know, our journey as musicians is much longer than that moment. And so I think that that's an important thing to try and remind ourselves of and to help students navigate if you're a teacher and using mindfulness as a way to help them be aware of what they're doing and how they're progressing, that those last two pieces are a part of mindfulness and that they may suddenly realize a thing that makes them frustrated. And that's exactly okay. And it's safe to feel those frustrations, but it's not about letting those define you. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That was awesome. No, that was wonderful. I love the five facets that you mentioned from Dr. Baer. I will find her information. I'll add it to the program or to the podcast notes.
Yeah, she's written so many. She's done incredible studies about how mindfulness shows up in life. And there's a questionnaire you can take, and I actually wrote one for musicians that's assessing how that, you know, we can be mindful in our daily life or mindful in our own musical life. And all five of those things, I think, transfer directly, and they're not always the same in our personal lives and in our professional lives, right? Like some of us are very mindless as we do the dishes, but very intentional about how we approach our instruments and vice versa. But she's incredible. So highly recommend.
That part that you mentioned, the non-judgment and non-reactivity, are those two individual facets or are those the same facet?
Was it no, those are individual. Yeah, those are individual.
So can you talk a little bit about the difference between those two? Because I think I understand, but I want to make sure that we're receiving it the way that you're intending.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. So in the questionnaire, when I work with students about this, the question about reactivity is when I make a mistake, I inevitably snowball into more. Because the reactivity piece of it is when our emotional state kind of takes over and it's, you know, we've assessed that there's a mistake and it's not just that we've noticed it, but that now it has caused some sort of turbulence and difference in how we are approaching the task at hand, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. Whereas judgment could be the error detection or even though I ask students sometimes, like if you're a person who, when you go to a performance, mostly what you notice are the mistakes, instead of being able to like sit back and enjoy the musical experience, then you might be someone who's struggling with non-judgment, right? That you're constantly looking for errors or, you know, kind of this checking boxes sort of a thing. And we all, you know, that's a helpful tool in our own musical development, but it can also really impede our satisfaction in music, I think. So kind of from that perspective, that judgment is assessing and reactivity is the part where it starts to impact the next phase of thing, the present moment.
Great. So I totally agree. I think being non-reactive, to summarize, let me make sure I'm getting it, that non-reactive is in the moment of performing or practicing, I suppose, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're working on being non-reactive so that a small mistake doesn't create more, right?
Right. Yeah. So, that's exactly right. So and then, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Oh, sorry. And then, non-judgmental would be after the fact. How to assess those errors that did happen?
Maybe I would say maybe more that non-judgmental would mean not ascribing like a value statement to it, right? So like non-judgment, it's not that I'm a bad horn player or that was a failure. It's like, that's just a thing that happened. That's new data to consider, right? Because, you know, ideally all of this is focusing on both being very aware in the present moment and kind of harnessing our attentional capacities, so to speak, but also building a healthier way of navigating that time, which I think as performers, since we put ourselves in such high stress situations often, having the tools to navigate it in a way that can stay a little bit more emotionally neutral than a lot of us go, can be really empowering. And it doesn't mean that you're not going to practice later to address the things. That's a different thing. That's like, you know, future Anne-Marie or Kevin's problem is the future, you know, practicing to fix those things. But in the moment, our job is not to shame ourselves for cracking that high C or, you know, try and remember all the reasons that we thought that was going to happen. Or, you know, we've all had that moment where you're like, I knew that was going to happen. But that's not really productive. And it's not living in the present moment. That's, you know, bringing in the past or the future. And so I think that in this sense, the non-judgment is a way of remaining engaged in the present because you're not giving it this immense emotional value, if that makes any sense at all.
It does completely. How do you guide students to practice that skill? Because I think that part of the benefit, in my view, of, you know, non-musically focused mindfulness practices, so, you know, on sitting in a chair without being attached to your music making, is to practice that that skill of observing and noticing reactivity, and then to practice non-judgmentally letting go of distracting thoughts and returning to your object of awareness, whatever that might be for your practice. So how do you guide a student to develop that skill so that they can use that in those moments when we really need it, you know, in the middle of Till Eulenspiegel or something along the lines?
That's a great question. So I think of it in a couple different ways. One, I think the more you are performing, the more you learn about your state of mind as you're performing. And that's a huge piece of it, is that we have to recognize that all of us are different. So for example, for me, I'm the person who, when I'm nervous, I suddenly hear like the person way at the back of the hall opening a cough drop. And that's all I can focus on. My brain's feeling like, what is that sound? For other people, it's like the racing heart. You know, like we all have different things. And we figure out what those are and how to recognize them coming by performing more often. So I think creating low stakes performance situations so you can learn that aspect of yourself, get acquainted with the performing you, is really powerful. So whether that's playing for friends or faculty members or, you know, at a nursing home or a church or on a street corner, you know, we can't always control when we get a gig or when an orchestra concert can happen. But we can put ourselves in a position to explore performing in a way that doesn't feel so high stakes. And I think that's one thing that can be really, really helpful. Another thing I encourage my students to do is to listen to live performances as often as they can. I think that now we live in this world where so many things are polished and recorded and edited by the time we hear them, that we assume that no one is making the mistakes that we make in the practice room. And I think that's also, ironically, one of the really beneficial things. There are a lot of incredible musicians who are posting practice accounts, which when that first started being a thing at the height of the pandemic, I was like, do we need this in the world? But I actually think we really can benefit from it because there's something really powerful about, you know, seeing a player in the New York Phil practicing and not having their best day, but still being at it and then coming back to it the next day and hearing those little increments of improvement. That I think can equip us when we realize we're not alone in this. We're all certainly humans, and we have to believe in that human element of it, that with that comes the risk that we might make a mistake on stage, but we're not going to fall on our face, because if what we're saying has so much intention behind it, I think listeners are very kind. But there's this analogy that Kabat-Zinn has in his book about hiking that I really love, that I think reframed for me what it meant to have a successful performance. So he talks about hiking a mountain trail, and he says, I want you to imagine that you've done it, you know, 10 times in a row. It would be physically impossible to put your feet on the exact same stones each time you climb the mountain. And that wouldn't be the point, but you can still successfully climb up and down the mountain, and it's different every time. And I think that sometimes when we're practicing, we're, you know, going for consistency, absolutely. But that doesn't mean it's going to feel the same way every time. Sometimes it doesn't feel great when we sound amazing, or sometimes we're really nervous about a thing and it still sounds incredible, or sometimes we feel really great and it sounds really great. Like those are the fun, really fun days. But I think that there's something really powerful in that, that what you're trying to do is to learn in such a way that each time you play it, you can say what you want to say, even if your emotional state or inner state or your chops feel dry or your valves need to be oiled or any of these millions of variables that can happen, right? Like, God bless reed players. I don't know how they do it.
Double no kidding.
Seriously. But that same idea of, like, you can have a really successful performance and it might be totally different in little nitty gritty ways that no one but you knows. From the last time you played it or from the next time you play it, but it's still a successful performance. I think that's really empowering. And when I read that analogy, it kind of changed my way of thinking about what my goals practicing really are, how I know when I really learned something.
Yeah, the idea of importance over perfection, mm-hmm. or the importance of going for it over yeah. more than just trying to play the right notes.
Yeah.
I remember that was something that when I studied with Jeff Nelson back at Indiana for my doctorate, and still kind of call him and text him constantly asking for this and that or whatever, you know, as we do with our teacher colleagues and friends. But one thing that he would always say is that if you're just going for the notes, then you have a very narrow window of success.
Yeah.
You know, like if you have a broader list of goals or aspirations for even just this one half note, you know, like I want to make it sound, you know, exciting, and I want to have this beautiful little swell in it, and I know that I need to play in tune with this instrument specifically, or trying to match this timbre, all these different elements and layers, then, you know, missing a little bit of that timbre, you still play a beautiful note, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That kind of
right.
a thing.
Exactly. I've started telling myself this thing when I'm performing. So, like, I had a concerto performance last week, and this really funny thing happened that had never happened before, where I somehow managed to half foul my thumb valve and it sounded like a duck quacking. I don't, it was, you know, one of those things that you're like, how did I do that? And I told myself, great, now there's no pressure for me to give the perfect performance. And then I immediately just like felt this relaxation, like I can just enjoy the rest of it. And it's the silly thing I started saying to myself years ago when I would make a mistake on stage, like, cool, now it doesn't have to be perfect. I'm not living up to perfection. And that doesn't mean I'm not going to try to make it beautiful, but it is, there's something about the humor in that, the kind of self-deprecating, like, oh, I'm not perfect. That helps me to really relax when things start to go sideways, to remember that I'm just a human. But the performers that I love the most are not the ones necessarily that are the most clean, or that, you know, you could record it and notation software would perfectly catch all the details. It's the one who really, you know, really say something about their playing. And I don't know, I'm willing to forgive a lot if someone is really moving my heart. And I think most humans are. And that especially as students, it's easy to forget that. Or when we're in an audition circuit mindset, it's easy to forget that. But I think that's also true of the panel behind. They're listening to me, like 60, 70 people play the same excerpts. They just want to be moved, you know? So I think that there's something really powerful in intention. That's the foundation of everything we're doing with music. And it can transform your fundamentals and your technique practice, but it also can be really liberating in the expressive sides of what we do. And so I think that kind of with these five facets of mindfulness, or just mindfulness as a practice, it's amazing how it can pop up in different ways as you walk with mindfulness for longer. Like at the beginning, it might be about performance anxiety. And then one day it becomes about how you're listening and catching the details of recordings, or as you're teaching. And I think it's a habit of mind that can be really, really powerful, and kind of, you know, delightfully ambiguous in how it will prop up in your life, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, it does. It does for sure. I know that feeling, since, you know, I think I myself for sure, and I think a lot of other artists, musicians, high level, you know, achieving type performer people approach mindfulness from the goal of having it as a skill to hack your performance to get better, right? That's how I first, you know, started to get interested in it. Like, this might be a way for me to like be a great performer. You know, I've always dealt with, you know, performance anxiety in one way or another.
Sure.
And once you start actually practicing it, then you realize that, oh, well, maybe it's helping my music, but what it's really doing is just helping me as a human being.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then every aspect of your life is a continuation of that kind of benefit.
So absolutely. I agree. 100%.
The idea you talked about regarding one's mindset while listening to live performance or any performance, can you elaborate a little bit more on that? Because that's a really important point, I think, for all of us.
Oh, yeah. You mean like the way, you mean the sense of non-judgment, or what I was just saying a second ago about like mindful listening?
Well, I guess both. In terms of listening to a performance mindfully with the mindset of appreciating it, the beauty for it, and rather than listening for mistakes, I think there's that really easy trap to fall into of almost, you know, waiting for mistakes to happen, especially if you're listening to this really great performer that you super admire. You know, you're like, well, I make mistakes, so if they make mistakes, you know, maybe they're not you know, the level of godhood that I ascribe to them.
Yeah. Which could be both empowering or snarky, I guess, depending on how you're looking
at it. Right.
Yeah. So I think that when I was a student, I was an undergrad, and I had like gotten to that phase where that was kind of how I was listening to live concerts. I was like, oh yeah, but then this happened and then whatever. And a really good friend of mine said a thing that I think about all the time. And it was also like one of the most devastating things anyone's ever said to me. He said, you know, that's the cheapest form of good musicianship. He's like, of course you hear that. Everyone in the room hears that. But if that's what you remember, I remember being like, oh God. And so I don't know that, I mean, like him saying that definitely challenged me to reframe my own thinking. That being said, that's not coming out from a mindful perspective. That's equally kind of like, shame on you. What I think is interesting about when we are listening, it's about why we are listening, I think. So if you're going because you just want to learn repertoire, like when students are preparing excerpts for the first time and they're listening, and they're just trying to get a sense of how their part drops into what's around them, right? There's that like first step of like, okay, now I know what the tempo is for this and who I'm playing with. And then as you listen to it again, the listening gets a little bit deeper because you're like, well, no, this person interpreted this staccato this way. And then the next person did it this way. And these are all kind of like purpose-driven listening, like where you're starting with a question, whether it's what's the tempo of this or what stylistic choice did that person make. And I think that you can kind of extrapolate from that into other things. Like it doesn't have to be a musical decision based thing, or a did they prove that they are a competent musician with this. Like that's where it loops back to the judgment when we're trying to decide if someone is right or wrong, or professional or non-professional, or any of the kind of challenging values we want to ascribe to a thing, right? So to me, one of the most valuable times in my life for cultivating this own kind of listening was when I was playing assistant horn a lot, which sometimes you're just sitting on stage doing nothing for a long period of time, counting rests. And I learned pretty quickly that I couldn't just stare at the conductor like he was a TV set, that was weird. So I had to start finding other ways to occupy my mind. And so I started just kind of like watching string players and listening to like seeing their bowings and then thinking about what that act, like noticing what it was they were doing that was getting the sound that I wanted. Or then suddenly I'd like listen to this color and how it would move and look at how people were communicating. And I think that you can kind of be endlessly curious in how you listen, and that, again, it comes back to kind of the intention of what you want to be listening for. So if you find yourself zoning out while you're listening, which I certainly have been in that point as a student too, where your professor says, okay, go listen to recordings for this. And it's really easy to just like have it on in the background and think, I don't know what I'm supposed to get from this. But you can listen for specific things, right? And sometimes those can be really specific. Like, is there space in this recording or not space? You know, like, I don't know, to use a horn excerpt as a really lame example, the opening of Chike 4, the classic example of like, do they use space or no space? Hmm. So it's a way of listening, right? But then, you know, you get into the kinds of things that people talk about in orchestration classes, which if I could go back in time, I would pay more attention to that. Like, why does Rimsky-Korsakov sound like Rimsky-Korsakov? Hmm. Or what makes the Philadelphia string section sound the way that they do? Or what was so magical about the way Barry Tuckwell played? You know, like there are all these things that you can kind of just ask questions and try and listen and not have it have a specific answer. And it's amazing where your mind will go. And sometimes that comes just from listening a bunch to things over and over, or listening to a bunch of different styles of music. So I don't know. I think that it's completely natural to hit a point in your musical training where you start to notice errors more often as your own musicianship is getting refined, because you're probably noticing those in your own playing as you go. And so it's not that I think there's anything wrong with having a season of your life where you suddenly become more aware of those things. But the goal is not to live in that place, I think, to recognize it for what it is, an opportunity for a thing that could have been more refined or could have been better. And then to start being curious about kind of the magic of the music, why we love it. Like, we don't listen to recordings or performances just to get a perfect representation of that. We can follow along to a score or listen to a mastered studio recording if that's what we want. There's that other piece of it when it's live humans in front of us. And I think that depending on the place where you are, you know, if you're hearing it in a new room for the first time or with a new ensemble for the first time or new conductor, I mean, there's so many ways that you can engage with it and be curious. So I think having an intention of, I want to enjoy this thing about this, or I want to learn this thing about this, even if it's a piece you've heard 1,000 times. So that was a very rambly answer, but I hope that it was helpful.
It was, absolutely. It's such an important piece is to decide how you are listening to something. The clarification I usually make is active versus passive listening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
oh, great.
Like you can listen passively to a piece that you're working on while you're doing the dishes, right? That's helpful in some ways, but it's also helpful in many other ways to be like listening very intently for specific ideas or with a score or however you're going to catalog that active listening exercise. The decision to have one or the other, I think, is really important.
Yeah, I think so too. And to maybe to give yourself permission to disengage, like if you hear an error and it's frustrating to you, then you can turn your attention to a different aspect of the performance. You know, there's so many different things you can be listening for, and right notes or intonation is just one of them. I think that's a way of approaching that. I don't know.
Yeah. Something I also picked up in what you were just talking about was we keep returning to the non-judgmental environment. Mm-hmm. Which is a staple of Jon Kabat-Zinn too. You mentioned him a couple of times.
Yeah,
that's one of his like key elements of mindfulness.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that we can cultivate all the time, not necessarily just regarding performance or the analysis of our own performance or anything, but also while you're listening. Let's say that you set the goal of, okay, I want to be really engaged with the performance and I'm going to listen past the wrong notes or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. If you realize that you're not doing that, don't beat yourself up for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So we're practicing that skill, you know, in pretty much every facet of our lives, is to be curious rather than, you know, condemning.
Yes. Oh, that's a beautiful way to phrase it, Kevin. And I think that all of these things are inward and outward facing, right? So the outward facing is showing that kind of non-judgment towards your colleagues, but then also showing it to yourself. You know, like you will recognize things about yourself as you become more aware of yourself that maybe need some maturing or tweaking or help, you know, and that's okay. So I think absolutely non-judgment comes back not only to kindness towards others, but kindness towards self.
Well, I'm sure we could go hours and hours discussing. It's been great talking to you. You have a lot of awesome, really interesting ideas, and I love the way that you say so much of these comments and everything as well. I'm sure people listening would love to find out more about what you're doing and where to talk to you and everything. So where are the best places to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am very easy to find on Facebook and Instagram. So on Facebook, it's just my name, Anne-Marie Cherry. And you can find me on the Columbus State University website if you want to shoot me an email. My Instagram is PocoMenoSnark, which is very silly. But I would love to get to know anybody. This is one of my favorite things to explore with people because I think that there are as many ways to talk about mindfulness as there are minds exploring it. And so it's really cool to hear other people talk about it. So yeah, please reach out. I love that. And then I have a website that's desperately in need of updating. It's just annemariecherryhorn.com. So you are welcome to go there. It just will look like a site under construction for a while.
As they often do. Websites tend to, you know, disintegrate as we as we don't pay attention to them. So well, thank you again so much. This has been wonderful, and I'm expecting another conversation between the two of us because I think there's many more topics that we could cover.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you for having me. This is such a delight, and I've loved the episodes I've heard so far. So I can't wait to hear what comes next on your podcast.
Thanks, me too. Another big thank you to Anne-Marie for a great conversation. And thank you all for listening. You can keep up to date on all new episodes by following me on Instagram at Mindful Musical Life and by visiting the website mindfulmusicallife.com, where you can also get in contact with me directly to ask questions or suggest topics or guests. I am also starting a new round of personalized mindfulness coaching, and if you would like more information about that, you can reach out to schedule a free consultation. Thank you again for listening, and see you next time.